Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
If there are international and national observers, particularly Catholic Church observers, Togolese will feel more confident for this election.
Civil society groups say the participation of independent poll observers in the coming election on Monday will inspire confidence among voters in Togo.
It was just one of the most exciting things that has happened in Sierra Leone. The president himself launched the program.
Sierra Leone's health minister expresses confidence in the sharp reduction in malaria rates among the population.
We saw that the commission submitted a report to cabinet with the recommendations that the terms of reference had said they should make recommendations.
And civil society groups in Botswana calls on President Mokgweetsi Masisi and the ruling party to withdraw the constitutional amendment bill from parliament. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Togo, civil society groups say the participation of independent poll observers in the coming election on Monday, April 29, will inspire confidence among voters. Jean Yaovi Degli is a human rights lawyer, a former minister, and leader of Build Togo, a civil society group. He says the Electoral Commission must demonstrate independence in administering the polls to ensure transparency and credibility. His remarks come after critics of the government express concern about intimidation and harassment of opposition and independent journalists ahead of the vote. They also say the refusal of the Electoral Commission to allow poll observers from the Catholic Church to monitor the vote is an indication that the polls will not be credible. But supporters of the ruling party deny the accusations. For the latest development in the run-up to Monday's elections, I reach Jean Yaovi Degli in the Togolese capital, Lomé.
If there are international and national observers, particularly Catholic Church observers, Togolese will feel more confident for this election because Catholic Church observers have already proved their credibility in observing election in our country. So the situation, the confusing situation which happened when they manifest their intention and not having already sent a request for observation, the Electoral Commission rejected their letter, like if they were already requesting for the observation of the election. But what is clear is that if there is no national observers, credible observers, because, you know, we can have also some observers that are just paid by one party or called by one party. Catholic observers are independent observers. And if you don't have also international observers in this election, there will be a feeling like if the election was not very, very credible.
Mr. Degli, some Togolese, including civil society and opposition groups, have expressed worry that the elections that have been postponed and now has been rescheduled might not be credible because some independent journalists are being arrested. There are some supporters of the government that are intimidating people, and, you know, suspicion is that the elections might not be credible. Are their concerns justified?
Yeah, to a certain extent, their concern is justified, especially if you refer to what we had as a precedent in our country. At any time that we don't have credible and independent observers for election, the election are not clear and not democratic. You know, effectively, we were informed about the situation of intimidation of some people inside the country, and it will be better for everybody to have what we can call independent arbitrator to monitor this election so that there is no contest after the election.
So, Mr. Degli, what are the expectations of Togolese from the Electoral Commission?
Always the expectation of Togolese is to see the commission being independent, not supporting any side, and lead the process with impartiality. Unfortunately for the Togolese, what we have as precedent and the various examples that we had in the past did not reflect this independence and this impartiality.
So what do you think the Electoral Commission can do, in your estimation, that can inspire confidence in the people of Togo?
If it is not too late, the Electoral Commission can accredit or accept international monitors to and national monitors like Catholic Check. But I think it is a little bit late now because, you know, we have the election on April 29th, and it will be difficult to let some people come in or some observers come in now for the monitoring of this election. But I think also that the way that the poll will go on when people will go to elect to the vote bureau can also give some sort of assurance, because if we don't have that, people will not be confident to go and vote, and moreover, the result will not reflect what exactly has been put or has been done in the poll itself. The proclaimed result will be different or will not be accepted by both parties.
Jean Yaovi Degli is a human rights lawyer, a former minister and leader of Build Togo, a civil society group. He spoke with me from the Togolese capital, Lomé. Sierra Leone's health minister is expressing confidence in the sharp reduction in malaria rates among the population. This after the government launched its malaria vaccine program. Dr. Austin Demby says the government in Sierra Leone is working closely with the World Health Organization, UNICEF, and the Global Vaccine Alliance in a program towards malaria prevention in the West African country. Sierra Leone joined Benin and neighboring Liberia as the latest African countries to be part of the Global Vaccine Program. It followed similar rollouts in Ghana, Cameroon, Malawi, Kenya, and Burkina Faso. For more on expectations and how Sierra Leoneans are reacting to the program since its launch, I reach Health Minister Dr. Austin Demby.
Well, the vaccine was launched on the 25th of this month, which happens to be World Malaria Day. And it was just one of the most exciting things that has happened in Sierra Leone. The president himself launched the program. And for us, you know, malaria being one of the biggest killers in our country, having this malaria vaccine, particularly targeted at children, gives us an incredible, incredible new tool in our arsenal in the fight against malaria. Again, this is done in conjunction with the insecticide-treated bed nets. We just ordered about 5 million bed nets in the country. We're also aggressively looking at insect control. We're also aggressively looking at rapid diagnosis and treatment. I think a combination of all of these and this new tool we have with the vaccine, we think that we'll have a really major delta, a major change in the malaria rates in our country.
How are they reacting to this malaria vaccine program? How have they embraced it? Talk to me about the experience of it.
I think people are really excited. I mean, you know, malaria impacts every facet of our lives in Sierra Leone. And so people are very, very excited at the opportunity that this presents. I know in some countries, you know, people have vaccine hesitancy, but we have nothing like that in Sierra Leone when it comes to malaria. We've spent the last year preparing the public for this, explaining to people how effective this vaccine is, how safe this vaccine is. And we have no problem whatsoever with everybody all through the country lining up to get the vaccines.
You know, there are some misconceptions that some of these vaccines are a Trojan horse to gather information from Africans or to cause harm to Africans. How are you reacting to such misconceptions or misinformation?
I think you're very, very right. Those are clear misconceptions and misinformation. What we have is a thorough scientific group in Sierra Leone that has looked at this vaccine, has looked at the data all through. We know the actual content of the vaccine itself. We know that the efficacy and the safety of it has been evaluated in multiple studies. We're also ensuring that as this vaccine is instituted, that we have the safeguards to ensure that any adverse event is quickly detected and managed. So again, we as a nation are very conscious of the importance of vaccines, and you know, I think we've had very good Ebola vaccines deployed. We've had a very good COVID vaccines deployed in Sierra Leone effectively. We have even newer vaccines like the HPV vaccine deployed in Sierra Leone, and we have a health workforce that has a relationship with the public, and the public trusts the health workforce in ensuring that these vaccines are safe and efficacious before they ever brought into the country.
What are your expectations of this malaria vaccine program? What do you expect for it to achieve before it's ended?
Well, it's not ending as such. You know, we're introducing this vaccine into our routine immunization program. What we expect is by using this vaccine and combining it with other countermeasures, such that the bed nets, such that the insect control efforts, such that the diagnosis and treatment, we hope that we will change dramatically the morbidity and mortality associated with malaria in Sierra Leone. And we're going into the rainy season now, and which is a peak period for malaria transmission. We hope that as we introduce this new vaccine, 550,000 doses that we're introducing right now of the 1.7 million doses, we hope that as we bring this in, you will see that the number of malaria rates throughout the rainy season is reduced considerably. And we're targeting children right now, but hopefully as this program evolves, will expand the coverage of this vaccine. So we expect to see a much steeper drop in the malaria rates this year and in subsequent years.
Dr. Austin Demby is Sierra Leone's health minister. He spoke with me from the Sierra Leonean capital, Freetown.
Why would a woman choose to be part of a polygamous union nowadays? Culture, economy, free will? And is this type of marriage beneficial to both women and men? On the next edition of Our Voices, we will explore the issue, ask questions, and hopefully get some answers. Join the conversation each week right here on Our Voices.
In South Africa, political observers say the formation of the opposition Nkonto Wesizwe party appears to have forced the ANC to bring out the country's former leaders to campaign ahead of the coming national elections. This after former President Thabo Mbeki and Kgalema Motlanthe were named in the ANC's campaign stops as the party tries to convince voters. It comes as latest opinion polls show that the ANC may not be able to win a majority, at least 50% of the vote, in the coming May vote. For the latest political development, I reach Professor Tinyiko Maluleka. He is a senior research fellow at the University of Pretoria Center for the Advancement of Scholarship.
It was always a little funny that the former presidents of the ANC appeared to be reluctant to campaign for it. But I think the move of Jacob Zuma the immediate former president in establishing his own party, has woken the party up and got the former leaders to spring into action.
But Professor Tinyuku, former President Thabo Mbeki vowed to remove what he called rotting apples and thieves from the governing African National Congress Party, or ANC. Is this not an admission for which opposition groups are campaigning for South Africans not to vote for the ANC in the coming elections?
Well, it is a kind of admission. I think the levels of graft and corruption in the ANC are no longer deniable. So the party has to come out and pronounce itself, especially for someone like President Mbeki, who has been talking about it already. But mind you, it's not the first time the ANC has admitted to guilt. In the last elections, the 2019 elections, the president of the ANC, President Ramaphosa, asked for forgiveness from South Africans as part of his campaign message. So clearly, they realized that this thing of corruption can no longer be denied, and they have to factor it into their campaign.
Has the Nkonto Wesizwe party led by former President Jacob Zuma, is that party taking away support from the ANC leading up to the election? Because latest polls show that the Nkonto Wesizwe party has garnered 15%.
Well, in terms of the polls, yes, they are showing up very well. But it is always important not to take polls literally. But what is true is that whatever inherent support they have is likely to be coming from former ANC supporters. So where they will do well, they will certainly harm the ANC. Especially in KwaZulu-Natal, it is expected. But overall, they are an unknown entity in the electoral spectrum of the country. So we can't make hard and fast rules about how well they will do. They may do well in one province and very poorly in other provinces. But they certainly have added to the headaches of the ANC.
Well, Professor Tinyuku, before you go, the Democratic Alliance, which is the main opposition party, appear to be gathering support from smaller political parties, so to speak. And then you have the EFF, which is the third largest political party officially, also trying to show strength. Are these the reasons why the ANC appears not to be, you know, surmounting the at least 50% of parliamentary votes that could make it form the government?
Well, two things are important here. Firstly, the narrative that the ANC will fall below 50% is itself part and parcel of the campaigning for the elections. It is as if those who push that narrative believe that the more you tell people that the ANC will fall below 50, then people will not even want to bother voting for the ANC. So it is not science. It is electioneering. Secondly, the DA's attempt to get all the smaller parties to unite under the so-called moonshot pact is an admission that the smaller parties are too small and too many to really bother the ANC each on their own. And so at the time when the ANC is at its weakest, we have the opposition parties proliferating and therefore thinning out their power.
Professor Tinyuku Maluleka is a senior research fellow at the University of Pretoria Center for Advancement Scholarship. He spoke with me from the South African capital, Pretoria. Forty-four civil society groups in Botswana are calling President Mokgweetsi Masisi and the ruling party to withdraw the Constitutional Amendment Bill from Parliament. Under the umbrella group, the Botswana Council of Non-Governmental Organizations, or BOKONGO, the groups contend that the administration has yet to include views and opinions from the population about the measure. This after expressing concern that it did not address major reforms needed to bolster democracy, the protection of fundamental rights of citizens, and the independence of public institutions. They also say there was not enough public engagement. The ruling party rejects the accusations. Olibile Machete is the chairperson of BOKONGO. He tells me that the umbrella group is considering all options, including a legal challenge, if the government does not withdraw the constitutional amendment measure being considered by Parliament.
We expressed the same sentiments to Office of the President, but nonetheless continued to participate, mobilize our members, make their submissions, and to also appear in all platforms across the country as the commissioners were undertaking their work. We also made formal submissions on behalf of civil society to just kind of consolidation of that which transpired. But having said that, we saw that the commission submitted a report to cabinet with the recommendations as the terms of reference had said they should make recommendations, which was very odd because that gives them the blank check to actually make recommendations even against the wishes of the people. But we saw them making the recommendations through a report to cabinet. Cabinet reviewed that and issued a white paper, which basically showed what the position of cabinet is with each of these proposals or recommendations.
What are the major concerns that your group has over this constitutional amendment process? What are the major concerns?
I'll move beyond the process, which I should say was not participatory to begin with. But beyond the process, the bill itself that's been gazetted entrenches executive power and deals, takes away a lot from the doctrine of separation of powers. It further weakens oversight institutions and increases the power of the presidency over all of the government's machinery. That is our biggest contention. The legislature, to a certain level, is weakened. You realize that one of the things that the bill is proposing is to increase the number of unelected members of parliament to make up about 16% of our entire legislature, which is quite a departure from what we have at the moment at around 10%. We feel we've come a very long way, where we expect to be having sound electoral reforms that will show inclusivity. We're still entrenching executive hold over the legislature by bumping up our legislature through unelected members who will be decided upon by the president. We looked at issues around the judiciary once more, issues around the judiciary, because there is already a judicial crisis, if I may, where we've seen lawsuits from high court justices suing the chief justice and so on and so forth. The credibility and integrity of the judiciary is under question.
Are you going to engage the government to address some of these major concerns that you've just raised?
We did. As per the law, once the bill was gazetted, we made our position and submission to Office of the President as the sponsor of the bill. We submitted that, which was quite surprising because even despite us making that submission on a Thursday, by Monday, the paper was in Parliament being presented. And one wonders, when do they get the time to appreciate submissions from the public? Because giving the public a 30-day window for them to prevail obviously requires that government has got to take into consideration submissions from members of the public and then make informed decisions on how they can proceed.
Yeah, but supporters are saying if wider consultations have been made in regards to the constitutional review process, then why should NGOs or civil society organizations threaten the government for doing the same things that you asked it for it to do by consulting widely before coming up with its paper and the bill, moving the bill forward?
Yes, the consultations were done. And I must say, I've said this before, we have to applaud the commissioners for they recorded exactly what the citizens said they want. Now, the concern is here. Firstly, there's been total disregard of what the public said they want in their constitution. And that is the major concern. The majority of the issues, that constitutional issues that were raised by members of the public, were disregarded.
Some people are asking, why wouldn't the civil society organizations continuously engage the government instead of threatening court action? What will the court action do for you?
How do we engage them? I've said to you, at the beginning of this process, we raised our issues and the government ignored us. So every single stage up to where we are today, we've been ignored and stopped by government.
Olibile Mashete is the chairperson of Bokongo. He spoke with me from the Botswana capital, Gaborone. In Kenya, the Center for Women Empowerment in Technology is helping to bridge the technology divide in rural areas in the East African country. The move, representatives of the organization say, is to equip young girls with computer skills. Judy Makairia is the co-founder and CEO of the group. She tells VOA that its core aim is to strengthen the role of women and to integrate them in the use of technology in socio-economic development. Judy Makairia tells me that one of the reasons for establishing the Center for Women Empowerment in Technology was out of a deep concern for the challenges women face in accessing opportunities that could transform their lives.
Oh yes, we want to bridge the digital divide, and not just the digital divide, but also the gender digital divide, and also the rural urban.
So for those who are in the rural areas,
yes,
you want to bring them to the light, so to speak.
Yes, to bring them digitally. To the light, digitally speaking.
Right.
Yes.
So what has been the effort to do that, and how has been the responses so far?
The response has been excellent, we must say, because this is a new venture. And we have put a lot of effort because some of the rural people, when we started, could not even touch a mouse. They had never seen a smartphone or even a computer or a laptop. So we've put a lot of effort, and we decided to put our center in the heart of the rural Murang'a County because we thought that the rural people need to also enjoy the tech space.
In rural areas, you know, sometimes electricity or power generation can be a problem.
Yes.
How do you surmount that?
Yes, we agree. One of the reasons, again, why the rural people are left behind is because of poor infrastructure. But I must say that currently the government is doing quite a good job. There's electricity. There's electricity. But the only thing that is not there is internet. So in our center, we have tapped free Wi-Fi hotspot for the public, and we are one of the places that you can actually access Wi-Fi without paying a cent. So by providing that, young people now are enjoying the fruits of the internet. Sometimes they just come and just to be in the internet without even knowing what they are doing, and we then take the advantage and we expose them digitally.
Who is funding this? Because somebody has to pay for it. How do you fund this program, especially in the rural areas?
We have different programs. So for the free Wi-Fi, we are partnering with a Wi-Fi provider. And he gives us, he's already supplying internet in the center, inside the center, mm-hmm. and is providing internet around the town to other very few and very rich homes. So we approached him and requested him to also partner with us. So we are partnering with him. But again, we in the center, we coordinate many other programs. We have a program for girls in secondary school called Binti Shupavu, where we partner with Daring Girls at Glami from Tanzania. And this program
is... So you do it both in Kenya and Tanzania?
Yes, we are doing in Kenya and in Tanzania partnership. Okay. In partnership. Mm. So Tanzania, it's carried out by Glami. So for that program, we have a partner called Daring Girls, the partner that has invited me.
What has been the responses of these girls that you want to bridge this digital divide? What has been their responses so far?
The response has been so good. They are happy, and some of them have actually now said that they are going to delve more into the tech world. So we've already have some of them who have become employable because of the digital skills. They have got jobs in the local companies. Some of them are now planning to pursue further tech-related courses in colleges and universities. As we mentor them, we also tell them now that if you are going to college, if your parent is sponsoring you, you can now further yourself. As if, even in the, as our organization, we are trying to bring in deeper courses like coding in the center. But meanwhile, we are encouraging these young people. If they get an opportunity, most have said that they will go into the tech space.
Before we go, what are your expectations or for the next at least 5 years to come? How do you want the center to look like? And this digital divide you are bridging.
Mm.
In the next 5 years, where do you want to see this?
In the next 5 years, we want to have more young people, mm-hmm. and especially young girls, mm-hmm. young women, exposed to tech. And not just exposure, the surface exposure, but also entering into the full tech space, going into careers at our tech. We are also hoping that in the next 5 years, we'll be graduating coding students. And when they do coding, remember now, they are already in the career of tech. And again, in our center in the next 5 years, because there are those, again, who would want to venture into other areas, we would want to introduce more vocational courses in the center.
Judy Makaria is the co-founder and CEO of the Center for Women Empowerment in Technology in Kenya. She spoke with me from here in Washington. Farmers in rural Malawi are learning to move away from over-dependence on maize as the only food crop that can meet their nutritional needs. A local charity, Never Ending Food, is teaching farmers about 200 types of food crops they can grow and eat. For VOA, Lamek Masina reports from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe.
Malawians have long relied on Nsima as their main food. The hard porridge made from maize flour is eaten with meat, fish and vegetables. This food is also eaten in other African countries in the region. But in Malawi, the saying goes, if you haven't eaten Nsima, then you haven't eaten. No matter what other crops farmers grow. The local charity Never Ending Food in Malawi's capital, Lilongwe, is working to change that. Manager Hadiwe Okanie says through permaculture, farmers learn about over 200 types of crops they can grow and eat, including cassava, potatoes, millet, sorghum, and yams.
The reason being not just for them to have a variety of foods on their table, but also to give them better nutrition. And when the farmers plant together different types of foods, it is also good for the soil. The soil remains nutritious.
Up to 40% of the population in Malawi is currently facing food shortages, largely because of El Nino-induced dry spell, which has damaged more than two-fifths of national crop areas, largely maize. The situation forced President Lazarus Chakwera to declare a state of disaster and appeal for international help. But Ethel Katumba, a single mother of six children, says Never Ending's food crop diversification training has helped transform her home into a house of plenty. while her maize is suffering in the dry spell, her cowpeas and other crops are doing well. She says in the past, she faced a lot of problems in situations like this. She used to beg for food from her employers or other people to survive. But now that she has learned to grow various types of crops, Katumba says she does not face food shortages anymore. The charity trains farmers and government agriculture extension workers, field officers from agriculture non-profits, and university students. Bright Kambalame is a permaculture instructor.
I choose to use this permaculture knowledge to improve the ecosystem here in Malawi and to improve the climate so that the future generation can have amazing environment that people can have plenty of food.
Advocates say permaculture can potentially address the food shortages Malawi has long faced. Daniel Jinghunta is a government extension worker who received never-ending food training.
Especially when we look into the rise in prices of fertilizers and then the rise in prices of hybrid maize, farmers are now taking it to their own to start engaging fully in permaculture practices. So I should say the response has been positive.
As farmers like Ethel Katumba learn the importance of food diversification, experts hope the hunger situation in Malawi will soon be history. Lamek Masina, VOA News, Lilongwe.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Samson O'Malley, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. But first, it's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Samson O'Malley. Hello, Samson.
Hi, Peter. Good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. World 800-meter silver medalist Emmanuel Wanyoye stepped up to the mile in style, breaking the world road mile record with 3 minutes 54.56 seconds at the Adzero Road to Records event in Germany on Saturday. Deciding to make his mile debut rather than raise his specialist distance, the Kenyan 19-year-old improved the previous world record of 3 minutes 56.13 seconds set by USA's Hobbs Kessler at the World Athletics Road Running Championships Riga 2023 in October.
I feel so happy for today. It's not just that I try to push myself, then my coach tell me it is possible to break world record 1 mile. My coach tell me if you run up to 200 meters to go, you can win this race.
Kessler on this occasion was second, chasing Wanyoye over the finish line in 3 minutes 56.18 seconds, while South Africa's Rian Mafilile was third in 3 minutes 56.45 seconds. Staying with athletics, the International Olympic Committee has distanced itself from the groundbreaking move by World Athletics to offer money to Paris 2024 medalists, saying its role is to level the playing field and reduce the gap between the powerhouses and the rest. World Athletics announced weeks ago that it will pay $50,000 to gold medalists in Paris, becoming the first sport to introduce cash prizes at the Paris 2024 Olympic Games. World Athletics President Sebastian Coe's announcement earlier this month that track and fields winners at the Paris Games will receive such monies has sparked mixed reactions, especially within the IOC, as no other sports federation pays prizes to its athletes at the Olympic Games. In football news, two North African football giants will collide next month over two legs for the right to be crowned champions of the CAF Champions League. Defending champions Al Ahly of Egypt will take on perennial rivals Esperance of Tunisia in this year's Africa Champions League final after winning their semi-finals on Friday. Al Ahly, who have won 5 of the last 7 editions and a record 11 in total, overcame TP Mazembe of Democratic Republic of Congo in Cairo, and Esperance pulled off a surprise 1-0 win over South Africa champions Mamelodi Sundowns in Pretoria, South Africa. Al Ahly won 3-0 after a goalless draw in the first leg in Lubumbashi for a comfortable aggregate triumph, while Esperance 20-year-old defender Raed Bouchiriba hammered home a clinical shot in the 57th minute to end the Tunisians a 1-0 away win and 2-0 aggregate victory. In tennis news, Tunisians Hans Jabeur is through to the round of 16 of the Mutua Madrid Open after dispatching Canadian tennis player Leila Fernandez in three sets. The 8th-seeded Jabeur outlasted the 21-year-old from Montreal for a 7-5, 2-6, 6-4 victory that lasted 2 hours, 24 minutes in Spain. Jabeur will on Monday take on Latvia's Yelena Ostapenko. And that's it for this week's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Samson. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Since the 1848 student revolt in Europe and decades after, students' disturbances and revolts have been an indication of their displeasure of the way things were occurring at the time. They were calling for change. Similarly, the current student demonstration is an indication that students in the global north are unhappy about what they may see as the callousness of their leaders. They do not see why it is so difficult to agree on a ceasefire to save the lives of civilians, particularly the large number of children. Those in the global north may wonder, why is it at this time the students in the global south are silent? They are silent not because they do not care, but they have gone through their own demonstration and struggle during the war of national liberation. In their view, what they believe emanates from the global north, the arrogance of power and how it's applied, has made them feel that the global north do not feel their pain. What they have done and the leaders have done in the global south is to do things to protect them. And here, the 10 countries of ASEAN have done remarkably well. They are united in their determination that outside partners should not mess in their region. In Latin America, under the current leadership of Brazil and Mexico, they too are trying to see how their region could be protected in the decline they see in terms of global security. But they know the difficulty for them. As generations before them have always talked about the peculiar situation of Latin America with what they call the Colossus of the North. It is only in Africa there seems to be little concern about the coming calamity. That is why it may be necessary for the people of the African continent to now prepare themselves. The current leadership of the African Union may soon have to make a difficult decision. The chairperson of the African Commission, Mr. Musa, will have to change in 2025 when his second four-year term ends. And the African continent must be very careful this time as to whom they should select. And they should move away from the current practice of not being careful of who that person should be. So I would suggest that as of now, they set a select committee to begin to look throughout the continent for an independent and competent chairperson of the commission. Many in the past have done well. But for me, I believe there is one model that they should look at. And for me, that is Salim Salim of Tanzania, who handled his job in a very competent and excellent manner. He worked in the United Nations as the ambassador of Tanzania. He led the African group, and no one can doubt that in his term as the then Secretary General of the Organization of African Unity, he performed well. So let Africa start now to find somebody who will pay more attention to how to protect the African continent from the pressures coming from outside. If they do so, then the people of Africa will be grateful that there will be somebody, a chairperson of the African Commission, that will protect them. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Hold your head if you please.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English to Africa service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Nicole Peters and engineer the great Justin Thwaite, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, don't think there are no crocodiles just because the water is calm. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa. Make me sure he loves.